Welcome to the conference room with this week's guest, Robert Freeman.
Once I remember I was struggling and he turned to me and all he said were these just four words. He said, "We believe in you." That's all I wanted to hear, all I needed to hear to keep me going. That to me was, that's another good sign of, you know, leadership.
Welcome to The Conference Room, a weekly podcast where business leaders and growth experts kindly share their experiences, actionable tips, and secrets to successfully grow a business. If you like the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a five-star review. It'll really help us out. And I really hope you enjoy this week's episode. I'm Simon Lader. Welcome to The Conference Room. Good afternoon and welcome to The Conference Room. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Robert Freeman. Robert is the Senior Vice President of Worldwide Sales of SafeBreach, a leading cybersecurity vendor. He's a results-oriented IT sales management professional that has over 20 years of experience managing in high-growth environments. He's a graduate of the University of Massachusetts, and his sales and leadership career has included positions with global vendors such as Cisco, Imperva, and FireEye, and startups such as Distill Networks and now SafeBreach, where he is responsible for scaling the company around the world. And I'm absolutely delighted that he's coming to the conference room. So Robert Freeman, good afternoon and welcome to the conference room.
Simon, I wish all my introductions were this happy, but thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here, man.
Fantastic. So all heroes have an origin story and you're the hero of our story. So tell me, how did you get from graduating in the University of Massachusetts through your sales career into leadership and now managing SafeBreach around the world?
Yeah. So I guess there's a good backstory here that, you know, it didn't really start out. I don't think anybody picked sales as a career. You know, it started out, I think even before college, I guess you could call it a nerd. My dad had an IBM PC to do his writing on it. You know, the old ones with the 8086 processor, that green monochrome screen, two floppy drives. And on that computer, I taught myself BASIC, you know, how to program. I built games. Obviously, they were all text games. And that's what I did. So went from there to understanding of the languages. During summers, I was working at a school, kind of as a utility player, typing in reports, cleaning, answering phones. But I would stay late and play around with their computers. They had this database called Paradox. So I learned it, and they eventually didn't need their IT consultant to fix it or program it. They just turned to me, and that kind of became my job. When I graduated college from UMass, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I just continued working at Star Market. It was a supermarket here in the area. About 6 months later, I'm guessing like 6 months, one of my best friends, Dave, he called me and said, hey, he was a company called Chipcom at the time, said, hey, you know, we need somebody who knows Paradox. Would you be interested? So I say, hey, how much money can I make? And I think back then, I think it was like $21,500 a year, which was a boatload of money for me at the time. So I said, yeah. I went, I interviewed, I got the job and ended up being a junior database administrator. And I kept that job for a year. At some point, I saw that they needed an inside salesperson that spoke Spanish. And you know, being from Spain, you know, my mom always forced us to speak Spanish at home, which was a blessing. You know, I decided to go for it, but I said, hey, can I make more money being in sales? They said, yes, you can make more money. I said, all right, I want to interview. So I went, I interviewed, and that's how I started my first sales job in tech as inside sales. I think we call it now business development, sales development, but back then it was inside sales. So that's kind of how I got my start in the industry.
So how did you get from inside sales through to external kind of fields, you know, selling in the field? And then traversing into leadership.
Yeah, I don't know if it was all by design. I'd like to say it was all designed, this big master chess game, but it really wasn't. Chipcom eventually got bought out by 3Com, so I had to find another job. And I found another job, but as a channel manager at a company called Axis. And then I was making a little bit more money. So then I kind of understood, hey, if I kind of just continue growing and moving myself up, I can get other jobs, I can make more money and start growing through the industry. So I went on to become a channel manager. I stayed as a channel manager for think probably till Aruba Networks. So that was around 2004, and went back to outside sales or into inside sales. I went into outside sales.
Right.
And from there, I think the management bug hit me. Right. So that's kind of how that happened.
Right. So what's your philosophy about successful sales leadership? What makes a successful sales leader?
Yeah. I think, you know, in a pedestrian, let's call it very simplified definition, I think a successful leader, you know, is one that can kind of mold people to work together like a smooth engine, smooth running engine. They can influence change, get to the destination or whatever your goal is. But like an outline, there's really, that's the main topic. And beneath it, there are many other supporting bullet points that when summed up can make a successful leader, right? Things such as understanding what motivates one person from another. Some people are motivated by winning, others by money. I guess we're all motivated by money in a certain sense, but there's also recognition, advancement. You know, you really have to understand what is important to that person. And as an example, one of my managers, Tiffany, a long time ago, she knew that, you know, what was important to me. And that was growth. So she taught me a lot. In a sense, she kind of took me under her wing, started teaching me things I didn't even know, kind of like these behind the scenes things. So you didn't think I was going to run through a brick wall for her? Absolutely, because she knew what motivated me and latched onto it. I think also, you know, clear communication, vision, those are important things, right? Creating the right culture. I also think what's important is supporting people. What I mean by this is in sales, I see there's ebbs and flows, right? So when the sales are ebbing and that person's kind of struggling, support them. But when things are flowing, you know, push them to do more, push them to be better. So another old boss of mine, Ralph, once I remember I was struggling and he turned to me and all he said were these just four words. He said, "We believe in you." That's all I wanted to hear, all I needed to hear to keep me going. That to me was, that's another good sign of, you know, leadership. So I know that a lot of these things are what I call the Facebook sayings, but they are valuable. You know, I think they do work. Transparency and directness. You know, sometimes directness isn't taken too well, but I think more times than not, the leader that's kind of poetic and flowery will lose rather than win. I think also... being a good therapist. I think that's a very important trait of a good leader, right? Because I think we spend half our time doing therapy.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And what struck me also is that when I was looking into your background to prepare for this conversation, you've spent a lot of time working for some, like we said, some very large companies, you know, Cisco, yeah, one of the biggest technology companies in the world, Imperva, FireEye, arguably the biggest, or one of the biggest security vendors in the world. And at the same time, not discounting your time at Distill and here at SafeBreach, okay? So putting the kind of resources that you have at your fingertips to one side, okay? What would you say are the primary differences as a sales leader that you have or you are confronted with when you're managing at FireEye versus managing at SafeBreach?
Yeah, I think there's a couple differences. The first one I would say is processes. You know, the bigger the company gets, the more processes it has or it needs to continue scaling the growth and being efficient. So I would say that is the very first difference. I think the second difference is, you know, you're missing things like resources. You have to do more with less at a startup. That's the flip side, is it makes it really exciting. Mm-hmm. Not in this little box over here that you can only do these four things. You know, startup, everybody says it's the term people use. I have to wear many hats. And you really do. You've got to understand, you know, from, you know, top of the funnel, middle of the funnel, you know, closing deals. You've got to be creative and you're allowed to be creative. So that's the beauty of working at a startup, right? The flip side is you don't have the resources a FireEye has, right, from a marketing perspective or other things like that. So you've got to be able to do more with less. So I would say the first two things that hit me, it's processes, and number two, it's doing more with less.
Right. So can you give me an example of perhaps a sales engagement or when you were working with some of your team in one of the startups or one of the early stage companies where you were confronted with a challenge and you had to be creative. And perhaps it really drew from your prior experience to be able to really move the needle with something.
Yeah. I think working at a startup, one of the things where we're always trying to be creative is having the ability, the flexibility to accommodate customer requests. Could be feature requests. It could be, you know, being part of your technical advisory board, things like that. So those are things, I'm not saying they're easy, but they're more, a small company's more willing and able to do those things. So you can have that leeway when you're talking to a customer to say, well, I want your product to, you know, be blue in the morning and red at night. Say, yeah, we can do that. And then you go back and figure out how to do it, right?
Right.
It's like, hey, the answer is yes. Now tell me, what's your question? Kind of
right.
Thing. So whereas I think in a larger company, it's more, well, we have a process, you can fit in the process, or, you know, you don't.
And do you see that being something where that kind of flexibility and freedom has drawn you more recently in your career towards the earlier stage organizations?
100%. To me, I mean, I guess the way I'm built, I'm really much more attracted to that than just fitting in a box somewhere. And, right, and there's personalities for everything. It's not a right, not a wrong. I'm just saying it's for me.
Yeah.
The ability to build, be creative, improvise along the way, and have that flexibility is just so much more attractive, 100%.
Right. So just sort of shifting gears ever so slightly. When you now run a sales team, okay? And you run sales teams in larger organizations as well. What are the key differences in the people you look for now versus when you were, for example, firing, you were hiring people there? What do you say are the key differences in the salespeople that you hire?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one key difference. I think when you work at a startup, you really need to find people with startup experience because it is such a much more demanding job, and you've really got to be able, again, you know, wear many different hats. You've got to be much more resourceful, independent, that self-starter stuff that you see, right? Whereas I think in a larger organization, you've really got to have that personality where you will fit into a process and succeed in that process, right? So there are two differences. That's kind of where you start. So in the smaller company, so the first thing I do is look, you know, does this person have startup experience? You know, at a SafeBreach, I'm not saying it wouldn't happen, but it'd be more of a challenge for somebody that came from a Checkpoint or a Cisco or an IBM to be successful in the startup environment.
Right. So, right. But I guess the challenge with that can sometimes be that it's one of those things, isn't it? It's hard to get the job without experience. It's hard to get experience without the job. So your first startup was your first. You didn't have experience of working for a startup before you had your first one, right? So what were the challenges that you encountered as you, maybe it was a little bit of a baptism of fire, as you first encountered these challenges that perhaps you haven't encountered before?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd like to tack on a little bit something. I think if you have a person from a Cisco, IBM, whatever, I'm just naming large companies, that want to go to a startup, as you're selling yourself to get hired, you also have to understand what your limitations are going into the startup and be prepared to answer why you would be a good candidate and what kind of startup-y things did you do at your company, right? So it's not just a one-way street. I've got to look at somebody, but that person may turn around and be able to sell themselves really well and then succeed. So I think it's kind of incumbent on both sides, right? That's the first thing.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, you know, as a person going into a startup, some of the shocking things were, well, where do I find this? You know, where is the rules of engagement for that? Well, we don't have it. Okay. You just kind of go out and do your own thing. You've got to be very, again, resourceful, invented as you go. And that's really a big culture shock where everything's kind of prescribed at a big company. And then a small company, you know, where do I find, you know, where's the training? Well, we don't have training yet. So you're going to have to look at this PowerPoint presentation, you know, things like that, that become a little bit of a culture shock. But then after your first, you understand it. This is all just part of the deal being in a startup, and that gives you great opportunity to create it. and to develop it and put together teams to help develop it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know that I mean, a lot of what I do is working with startups, right? And the one word that kind of comes up more and more is independence versus conformity. As in, really to your point, when you're working for an IBM, when you're working for a Cisco or FireEye, because there are processes, someone that's not going to conform to them, even if conformity may not necessarily be the right thing to do in that deal at that time, it can kind of start to upset the apple cart and all sorts of things can start to go awry, you know, further out, okay?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think my mom would agree with you. She'd say I was always a rebellious kid. So that non-conformist rebellious kid, she you'll be her best friend right now. But I think there's a lot of truth to that. Absolutely.
And that, but by the flip side, in an environment where there are no, I won't say there are no rules, because of course there are, but there's a much looser structure, and there may be certain areas where, that, like you say, there just isn't process, or it's not really been done before, or you can shortcut a lot of the things that may take several months, can be achieved in a couple of phone calls, you know, when you're at a startup versus, you know, a huge global company. Having someone that's got the independence of thought and the freedom, not just to thrive in that environment, but also not to be, like you say, inhibited or intimidated by the lack of process, by the lack of structure.
Right. It's very important. And I think that skill of identifying gaps, and it doesn't matter. I mean, I kind of look at it this way. It doesn't matter what your title is. We all have a role, and our role is to make this company successful. Mm-hmm. So if you, as you know, if your title happens to be sales rep or some derivative thereof, and you see that we have a gap, there's no reason why you can't develop ideas or program and present them. Like, I think this is how we address this gap, right? You know, we may not have rules of engagement. Well, this is what I think the rules of engagement should be. Or, you know, our channel program, we don't have this for the channel program. Why don't we look at that? And that's a great thing about the startup. But you've got to have people that have that, what's the word I'm looking for, that initiative. Right. It's not just coming in, like you said, fitting within a system, letting the system take you. So you've got to create that system. Within a system, there's just so many different parts and pieces. Mm. Right. You know, there's a lot of things like coming into Distill Networks or coming in here into Safe Breach. Right. There's things that are missing. It is a startup. That's just the way it is. So let's develop them. And the great thing about here is that's everybody's in the, you know, rowing in the same direction, want to develop it. Everybody wants to make this company successful.
Right. So when you're interviewing, how do you measure that? How do you, you know, put your finger on the pulse or take an X-ray of their brain to determine how much of what you need is there? I mean, someone in good reading a resume, and yeah, this guy did, you know, 120% of his quota last year and was president's club or whatever. But how do you actually, when you're sitting opposite the table or both, you know, looking into your webcams, how do you measure that when you're interviewing them?
Well, if I had an answer for that, you and I wouldn't be here, right? I would be off selling these secrets somewhere, Simon. But, you know, the reality is hiring is just an imperfect science. I think we've all kind of have our processes. We all have the things that we look for, some of the intangibles, some metrics, et cetera. And it's an imperfect science. I remember at a previous company, I won't name the company nor the person. I mean, this person we hired for an outside sales position. And this individual had all the perfect resume. Everything fit from, you know, where this individual was targeting, the companies that this individual worked for, references checked out, backdoor checks, you know, were good, and failed within 6 months.
What do you pull that down to?
I still don't know. I still struggle. That's one of those lessons that I still haven't, you know, understood. Again, it goes back to the imperfect science. But when I'm interviewing people, you know, it's there's an art to it as well. I mean, those are some of the intangibles. I think the number one thing I look for is energy. We got to have energy in this role. Sales can be very taxing. It is a very taxing career. I know that we're not, you know, laying asphalt in Alabama in the summertime. You're not putting your life on the line for your neighbor, right? Essentially, we're on a computer, playing on Zoom, on the phone. We get to travel. The travel's paid for. We're entertaining customers. Meals are paid for at nice restaurants, right? Sounds like a dream job. But the reality is, it is very demanding, very stressful. You need energy, right? You've got to stamina. You got to have the stamina, right? To deal with all the pressure, the responsibility, the end of quarter, the multiple calls. Yeah. All these things that come with sales. And then there's that, like I mentioned before, the ebbs and the flows of sales. So I think that's the number one thing I look for. I think the second thing obviously depends. Is it a senior sales role? Is it a junior sales role that you're looking to hire? I think junior sales roles, right? Do they seem coachable, right? You get that from talking to them. How hungry do they seem to make a name? Where do they want their career to go? Those are some other things, basics. Mm. But I also look for traits like humility. I think that's really important. While that may be counter to the stereotypical alpha salesperson, but I think both traits can coexist and should coexist. So, is there humility? Is there, what are the lessons that they've learned? Ask them, what did you talk to me about your greatest loss? They can go through and name it. But if they tack on afterwards, this is what I learned from it, that's a plus. If they just tell you about their greatest loss, to me, that's a negative. What did I learn from that loss? What did I learn from that win? Right? Because we're always learning. At least I think we always should be. Mm. And, then you got your track records, where they've worked, what type of accounts they've focused on. Again, am I hiring for a startup? Are they from a startup? So those are some of the things that I'm looking for. It's the energy. It's, what type of role is it, senior, junior role? Are they coachable? Do they learn? Is there humility? Those are some of the intangibles, the art to it.
Right. No, that's great. So when you've come into a company and you've started to build something from nothing, perhaps build a new territory and really start to look to scale, okay? When you're assessing things like product market fit and you're assessing how you're actually going to sell this, when you're the first guy on the ground and you're really kind of the pathfinder, the rainmaker, okay? The guy who's kind of coming into a territory, perhaps North America, and you're selling it for the first time and really starting something out, okay? What are the key things that you're looking to achieve in terms of shaping the sales message, and how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, there's so many facets to this answer, but I think I would start off by saying, like anything, you need a plan. Nobody does anything without a plan. You can't just go out there and knock on doors and say, I got this great widget I want you to buy. You need to have a plan, right? And part of that plan has to be, what is the market for your solution, the addressable market? And it's not just how many global 2000s or Fortune 1000s are there in a certain area, but who's your competition? I think a big thing like what we do here is within the global 2000 or Fortune 1000, which of those are more mature, which are medium mature maturity level, because a solution may require very mature sales, a very mature security organization, or maybe it requires just a basic security. So then you can start kind of fine tuning. So it's not just how many Fortune 1000s, it's not just the verticals of finance, is it healthcare, but what is the maturity level of who I'm going to target? And within those targets, who has my competition? They can really whittle it down to be focused. That's part of your plan. This is what I want to go after. I think that's important. Another thing that, and I've done this before, is you go out and talk to a friendly, people you've sold to before. It's not to sell them. We make it clear from the beginning, but it's get their feedback, right? These are the people that would be buying your solution, but hey, who should I be talking to within organizations? Tell me how the message sounds. Ask for 30 minutes of their time. Get feedback and continue honing that message. I think that's very important. So now, in a sense, you've got your external. I'm working here on my message. Does it resonate? Does it not resonate? So I think that's really important, both of those things. I could go on, talk about, eventually, what is your go-to-market? What is your channel strategy? When do you employ a channel strategy, that kind of thing. So onboarding is very important too, as you grow out your team. I think defining ramp, this is a big thing. This is one of the things that drives me nuts, right? Ramp.
Go on.
Okay, 3 months to ramp, 6 months to ramp. But my first question is define ramp for me. And that's when you see a lot of companies struggle. They're like, well, it's, when they close their first deal. Well, what if they walked into a deal and they close it in a month? Is that your ramp time? Okay, well, it's when they create their first opportunity. Okay, how do we know it's an opportunity? Right. So I think you can have many definitions of ramp. I think each company, instead of just saying ramp, has to define what their ramp is, because then you know before this person has the impact I want it to have, it's a 3 months, it's 6 months, it's 3 months, 4 months, five, whatever that amount of time is. Mm. Right. But I mean, that's just a side note that it drives me nuts. We don't have ramp defined in most companies. We just throw it out there. It's like a cheap term, ramp. It's a 6 month ramp. What does that mean? You know, it's like culture. And I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but we have a great culture. Yeah, define your culture for me. Well, we collaborate a lot. It's not a culture.
Yeah,
those are the softer things we've got to define.
Absolutely. And also, what's really interesting is that I had a conversation recently with a former CEO that oversaw a close to $6 billion merger, okay? And he was talking about the fact that the single biggest challenge with that merger was bringing together the two cultures, because the product fit was very, very neatly aligned, because they were two competitors that were, to all intents and purposes, basically doing the same thing, okay? So bringing those two products together and merging that product set was relatively simple and straightforward. The harder thing to do by a long way was the culture, because the two cultures are very different. And to your point, culture is one of those things that's so, because it's so intangible, and you can get 10 guys in the same company that will describe the culture in 11 different ways, right? So
right.
Being able to, obviously to his point, merging these two cultures when they were so intangible was extremely difficult, but really in any organization, getting to get an understanding of what that culture is and therefore what a culture fit would be for someone coming in. I would say for me as a recruiter, the hardest thing to get right is the culture fit. The 100%. Hardest thing. And my way is actually a bit kind of blunt instrument, is that I try and talk to as many people in the organization as possible and just get a sense of what the individuals are like. I've got no idea what the culture of the company is like, other than what I, you know, see being posted on social media, how enthusiastic about the company people are. And then getting a sense from talking to people, what are they like? Because at the end of the day, an organization is merely a collection of individuals, right?
100%.
And if I get a sense of, okay, these people are super high energy and super aggressive, then someone who can I have that feel about is likely as not to fit in, right? But for me, honestly, it just comes down to, if I like the people in the company and I get on with them and I like the person that I'm talking to, then the chances are they're all going to like each other.
Right.
And I know it's a bit blunt instrument, but it kind of works.
It does. Some of the old tricks still work today, right? Some of the basics work. And that's something I like to always say. The basics work is a tried and true through time. The chemistry thing, another one of those cheap terms, but it's true. You know, if I'm interviewing at a company and I don't feel the chemistry with the person, I'm out.
Mm.
Right, I don't want to continue, and you know that's happened to all of us before. But I think what you said here, when you talk to people and you gauge their enthusiasm, right, that's directly related to the energy. If you talk to a company where everybody's enthusiastic and everybody seems to be on board, and that bodes really well, and then you know who you're talking to on the other end, and yeah, what is it, 80%, 90% of the time, it's going to work.
Yeah, absolutely. So. No.
Well, I was going to mention about the culture thing too. You very interesting. I've been involved in two acquisitions. Once we were the company acquiring somebody else, but I was just along for the ride. And another one, we were acquired by a company and I was part of the acquisition. So two different perspectives. But the number one thing that you said, it's culture. The first one, where I was along for the ride, the two cultures did not mesh, did not fit, and it just created a lot of issues, a lot of problems. So having learned that, in the next step, when I was involved in being acquired, you know, we really looked at it. We took a different approach. I can't give away the state secrets on that one. But we took a different approach to make sure that the cultures, they didn't have to be exact, but that they would mesh, that the cultures would mesh. And that was very important. So 100%, but you can't quantify culture, right? You can't give it a rating.
Mm.
You can define your culture, and I think we have to define the culture, right? But you can't really measure it.
I think what's so interesting is that when, I mean, we see it, you talk about acquisitions, and we see it happen a lot, particularly within software, right? Where you'll get a Mandiant that gets acquired by FireEye. You'll get a, there are lots and lots and lots of small companies that go and get themselves acquired by whacking great big ones. And suddenly you have all these people, okay, maybe not suddenly, there's sometimes there's a little bit of kind of lead time, but you have all these people who are used to a startup mentality, a kind of free flowing latitude, okay, that suddenly are parachuted into an area where there's enormous process, where things need, I mean, the amount of times where a small company goes and gets themselves acquired by IBM or Cisco or HP or Oracle or Broadcom, whatever, and then suddenly they've got huge amounts of process. And what I find staggering is the fact that in short order, a lot of their best performers, particularly from a sales perspective, leave because they're like, I didn't sign up for this, you know? I want to work for a 200-man company, not a 200,000-man company with all the processes involved, you know? So very often they'll look at this company with this, you know, $100 million ARR or whatever it is and think, right, we're buying that. And then suddenly the people who are significantly contributing towards the powering of that 100 million leave, you know?
It goes back to what you were saying before. You have two personalities, the conformist and then the rebel, whatever, I don't remember the term you used, but the rebels inside the, you know, small company that now has to go conform, that does not match. Yeah. We went through this, you know, with Distill and the acquisition of Distill by Imperva. We went from a small company to being acquired by a mid to large company. And, you know, they did a lot of things right. And I still kind of remember, you know, that, you know, we looked at, first of all, openings at Imperva. Where can these people from Distill fit in, right, to keep them, right? I think that was great. And I think number two, it's really working and coaching these people that it's a different environment, it's a different company. And yeah, of course, you had some attrition, the conformist versus the rebel kind of thing. But we really tried hard to do things, make sure that these cultures meshed.
Right. Okay.
In the beginning.
So what are your three tips for somebody who wants to be successful in sales leadership?
Yeah. I don't know if, again, I don't know if there's like one standard recipe that makes success. I think the first thing I would say, it's you've really got to pick your technology right. I've never opted for working at a high volume company. I've never chosen a company that might have a very small niche company that there's at least a value and you can see growth. I think you really have to pick that company good, right? The challenge we're just talking about of working at a startup or a small size company, it's unbeatable, right? You learn so much, what you get exposed to. And there's tons out there. I don't know how many companies are under security, 3,000 or something like that, right? But you got to just pick your company well. It's like picking a partner. I think number two, it's humility and modesty, right? You got to understand, you don't know everything. I don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. So you just got to be, you got to know who you are, who you're not, and make sure that you continue growing and learning. Have that hunger to learn and to grow. You got to be able to say, I don't know, and then go figure it out. But I think, you know, within that, to help you learn and grow, you've got to get some good mentors. I like to call them my rabbis, right? But I've had a lot of great managers, a lot of great coaches. You know, I still turn to them today, right? So get good mentors. Pick some good technology. Learn. And I think a fourth one, I'll add a fourth one, even though you asked for three. Don't make any excuses. Don't rationalize. Don't blame. Right? Just take accountability. Right? I think people understand that we're human, we're going to make errors, we're going to make bad decisions, wrong decisions. But just take accountability for whatever it is, right? People see the rationalizations, the excuses, the deflections. That does you no good. So that's kind of some of the things I've been thinking about.
Great stuff. So tell me about Safe Breach and what's next for them and for you moving forward.
So I got to tell you, I love it. I'm coming up on my 1-year anniversary here. An amazing company, really amazing company. I really think that the technology, the platform, is leaps and bounds ahead of everybody else in this space. And we're led by two eminences in security, Guy Vajrano and Sid Kotler. Built the leading BaaS platform, I think. But another thing is the culture, right? And yeah, I can define the culture here, but the culture, it's like no other I've experienced before, right? I think the very first thing I'll say about the culture, there are no me monsters in this company.
Wow.
You know what I mean by the me monster, right? Yeah. They're in it for themselves.
Yeah.
And it's just about I. They use I all the time. No, I'm not one person here is like that, right? So I think with all that, it's not something I haven't really experienced before and got a recipe for success. You know, we're helping many Fortune 500 companies understand, you know, an ongoing way what their security posture is, you know, lessening the risk that something happens. And I really feel it, that we're making a difference for these companies and for these individuals in these roles in these companies. You know, prior to my arrival, the channels team did an amazing job of pivoting us to a channel-centric organization, top research organization, top customer success and engineering. So, you know, all the pieces for continued growth are here. We continue expanding with new features, new functionalities. We grew our customer base tremendously last year, a new customer base tremendously last year. So it makes for a really exciting time, Simon. I know that there are some headwinds. We all understand that we're kind of in some, a rougher economic time period here. But, you know, luckily we continue chugging along and doing really well.
Great stuff. And if people wanted to reach out and connect with you or do business with Safe Breach, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I think the best way, and I answer just as many LinkedIn as I can, because I've been on the other side, reaching out to people on LinkedIn. But yeah, the best way to reach out to me is through LinkedIn.
Okay, great. So I'll make sure the link to your LinkedIn page is posted in the show notes below. Robert, it's been an absolute joy hanging out with you. And we didn't even talk about whiskey. I mean, we did before we started recording. We didn't even talk about whiskey.
You owe me one. The next time we'll talk about whiskey, but I appreciate it, man. This was a great conversation. I wish it could last longer. Next time we have it, we'll pour each other a virtual whiskey.
We certainly will. Robert Freeman, thank you so much for coming to the conference room.
Coming up next week on the conference room, I'll be talking to Chief Marketing Officer of cybersecurity vendor Axonius, Nathan Burke.
Put that all together, and I think you have a pretty compelling case to be made. Now, the product has to do it. If you make a great case and tell a great story and the product doesn't work, that's not a good outcome. But I think if you really do have a product that works and it is something that stands out and you're just saying, if only the world knew about it, I think getting to that point where you know, in your 10-slide deck, if I've got a conversation with the right person.
Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it. And make sure you visit our website, theconferenceroompodcast.com, to see all the other episodes and to get access to the show notes and resources mentioned in this episode. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your network, or better still, go on to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other podcast platform and leave us a 5-star review. It'll only take you a moment, but it'll mean the world to us. And please don't hesitate to tell us which topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes. To get in touch, drop us a line in the comments section or send us a message on social media. Just search for The Conference Room Podcast or me, Simon Lader, on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or TikTok. I'm always open to a conversation. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you'll be alerted when a new episode goes live every week. Thanks so much for listening to The Conference Room, and until next time, keep talking.